You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 9th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kate Aronoff, writer from The New Republic, will be joining us to talk about COP27, which ended probably 2 weeks ago now. Took place during the midterms. The run-up and the aftermath. We'll get a sense of what came out of that meeting on climate change in Egypt. Then Jonah Furman from Labor Notes will be here on the impending rail strike. May also talk about this UC teacher strike, or I should say, teacher strike, 48,000 people on strike in the University of California system. Meanwhile, over 400,000 ballots cast in Georgia in early voting. Big numbers. Don't know much about those votes, though, as we head to the, well, I guess a week from today, the runoff election in Georgia. Meanwhile, Arizona, the state, sues an Arizona county refusing to certify the election. Remember on that night I kept saying Maricopa? They're going to be talking about this for decades? Well, Republicans doing an autopsy on why they failed in 2022. They're not calling it an autopsy because they didn't listen to their last autopsy. Senate will vote today to protect marriage equality, both same-sex and interracial. Yes, it's 2022. Clock ticking on the Pregnant Workers Fairness Bill and the Supreme Court to decide on the federal government's ability to have prosecutorial discretion on questions of immigration and deportation. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, torture sites uncovered in the recently Russian-evacuated Kherson. U.S. Supreme Court counsel running interference for Sam Alito over his Hobby Lobby leak, maybe in anticipation of having to run interference for him on his Dobbs leak. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Of course, it is. What day is it, Emma?
It's not, though, because isn't Newsday happening tomorrow, from what I hear?
That's true. All right. So it's
just Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Tuesday without the frills.
Not Newsday.
Wow.
And tomorrow's Wednesday, Newsday.
Mm.
Okay.
That doesn't work that well.
Sorry, folks. I was listening to my app at the beginning of the show. I was checking out. Somebody had mentioned.
He's addicted to it.
I'm addicted to this app, the Majority Report app, and I love to listen to the show when it goes live on it, which you can do by downloading the new app at majorityapp.com, the iOS. Kyle is working on the Android. Someone just sent a note in. Can you have the YouTube on for the listen live version of the show? And I don't know. I'll talk to Kyle about that. I don't know if we'll have to wait for the next update, but maybe he can put that in the Android version. But just to be clear, if you go into the app, you can watch the show on YouTube live very easily. All you got to do is you go in and you just go up into that little menu bar that's up on the left-hand corner. It's like three lines, classic menu bar thing. Then you just hit YouTube, and that'll take you right to our live video. And there it is. There's some ads right there now, but forget that. I'll skip the ads. And
You just go up into that little menu bar. That's
there
you
go.
And there it is. Majority Report, like magic. Inception. Like magic.
That's how good that app is. You just can't.
How come I can't hear Emma in my my headphone? Is she coming up? What? I'm not hearing Emma in my headphone.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Now,
I just put her down in the studio because she was coughing.
Yeah, it was just a little water, though.
Okay.
And went down the wrong way. Hello.
Hello. Well, we should also say that Bradley went home sick. This is going to be something we'll talk about when we talk to Jonah Furman about what's happening with the railway strikes, or soon to be.
And he was allowed to go do that and didn't have his pay docked.
And he's fired. So
well, wait back. A second. Wait a second. Don't get it. You're not locking me into that. He didn't get his pay docked.
It's not about pay. It's about control.
There's going to be a whole, what we're going to do to illustrate what's happening with the railway strike. There's going to be a whole lot of pink slipping going on around here. Ooh. And then we're going to call him from the sick bed and tell him that he better get back in here. So
hope he's not listening on this Majority Report app.
Well, there we go. We've gone full circle. Speaking of full circle, here is Sean McCarthy. He is not Sean McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy with Sean Spicer on and Lindsay Keith. That sounds like a radio name. On Newsmax, and there is McCarthy is not a very good majority leader. Let's just make this clear in terms of like trying to marshal his caucus. The Republicans were able to pass one significant piece of legislation during the 4 years that Donald Trump was president. That is it. Period. End of story. There was no other major piece of legislation they were able to pass. That legislation was tax cuts for wealthy people. A fairly uncontroversial piece of legislation within the Republican caucus. Outside of that, this guy has always been considered a bit of a dim bulb, but what he can do is raise money. And that's why he got those votes. Increasingly, there are other sources of money in the Republican Party, and that is creating all sorts of fractures there. They are threatening. There are people who are threatening to run against him for his leadership. I imagine they will be negotiating some stuff. But here is McCarthy. And you'll note that the chyron there is McCarthy calls on Mayorkas to resign. This is what their go-to is. It is the only smart thing that they have done instead of course, you know, pursuing the fact that the election was stolen in Maricopa County, and instead of trying to pass like a federal ban on any health care for kids or people who are trans, any gender-affirming care, which was a huge loser for them in the general election, they went back on an old trusted tactic of attacking immigrants and non-white people. Here is McCarthy.
I've had a couple of these folks that say that they won't vote for you on the show. When we ask them what they want, they list a couple rules concessions that they want. Then we say, well, if you get those concessions, will you vote for McCarthy? They say, well, we're not sure. Well, then who do you want your candidate to be? We don't know that. You know, one of those people suggested Jim Jordan. He's supporting you. Marjorie Taylor Greene supporting you. Donald Trump supporting you. You've raised, what, $500 million? Some of these people, you've actually funded their races. The thing that I don't understand is I don't envy your task. These folks, aren't giving you a target. I get your point. There's no alternative. Everybody has voted for you. The conference has spoken. And as James Comer at the top of that clip said, you know, you've earned the opportunity. You were the quarterback, the coach that led him to the big game and won. So the question is, going back to what Lindsay said, you've got five people that you've laid out all your cards out there. What is it that you are able to say to them that is going to change them at this point to get you to 218?
Well, we have to listen, but you have to listen to everybody in the conference, because five people on any side can stop anything when you're in the majority. I think when you look at the past history, when Paul Ryan ran, he had more people vote against him in the conference, and then they voted for him on the floor. We got 5 more weeks. We're working through our conference rules today. We want to make sure that everybody has input, but we have to speak as one voice. We will only be successful if we work together, or we'll lose individually. This is very fragile that we're the only stopgap for this Biden administration. And if we don't do this right, the Democrats can take the majority. If we play games on the floor, the Democrats can end up picking who the speaker is. So I think at the end of the day, calmer heads will prevail. We'll work together to find the best path forward. And I believe at the end of the day, since I've been leader, all we've done is been able to gain seats. We have not lost seats. We've won seats each and every time where the rest of Republicans have lost. So I think at the end of the day, we'll find the right path and we'll make the American public proud of what we're able to accomplish and turn this economy back around, because we're going to focus on the people, not on politics.
Now, I've been told that it's impossible that the opposite party in this situation would be able to pick. And so maybe he's just completely lying. But I think the idea is that there's simply no candidate to run against him. And so they don't think that he doesn't, you know, he knows he has to maybe make some minor concessions, but there's no one literally to run against him, at least within the Republican Party. But it's fun to watch the headaches they're going to have. Presumably, this is really about who's going to get to chair the Hunter Biden investigations. And I will say that in this context, right, it is going to empower people who I think are going to, in many respects, disempower the Republicans in this particular instance. Like, I do not think it behooves the Republican Party to have Marjorie Taylor Greene or someone of her ilk chairing endless hearings on Hunter Biden, but they're going to do it. And this is going to be one of the ways that they do it. And more power to those people.
I mean, this is just another instance of the monster that they created coming back to bite them. I mean, one, like, they were already going to have issues given the slimness of the majority. But the reason that the issues are exacerbated and why maybe, like, they have a harder time wrangling their caucus than, say, Nancy Pelosi has had with that same margin is because of the crazies in the party.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. And when we talk about fundraising ability, what the way that Marjorie Taylor Greene is able to leverage her kind of power is because she has that capacity at this point.
Why does McCarthy have the capacity? Is it just California or what's his?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's why, like, Hakeem Jeffries is taken more seriously and, well, he's been groomed for this. But that's why, like, there isn't much of a push behind someone like Tim Ryan when he tries, because they want these leaders to be in big moneyed, like, coastal centers so they can rake in dollars.
The Steny Hoyer, obviously, from the credit card center of the universe in Delaware and where a lot of corporations are registered, collects a lot of money, doesn't have to do much of his own fundraising, or I should say his yield is so high and he's so willing to take corporate money that it frees him up to go and, or did, to go fundraise for other candidates around the country, and it builds a certain type of loyalty. I mean, we talked about this for years. I remember 10 years ago making the comparison to, say, a guy like Jim McGovern, who is a congressman from Worcester, Mass., that district anyways. You know, here's a guy who's not taking big corporate money. He's and he doesn't have the ability to basically not worry about his fundraising and go around and raise big money for other candidates. AOC does.
Right.
And she has begun to leverage that, not just for progressives, but also for centrists. And I don't know how many conservatives, but at least at the very least centrists. And the idea is, for better or for worse, I would suggest that it's for worse, but it is the way that the game is played. That is the way you build power, or one of the ways that you build power in the House is you help fellow members who end up voting for you at one point or voting with you. I should say Steny Hoyer from Maryland, not Delaware.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
And also, just like, I saw some people saying, well, progressives should field Katie Porter for as an opposition kind of party leader, and that's the reason why she's not going to be the pick if anyone tries to, and it doesn't seem like they're actually going to challenge Hakeem Jeffries, but because she's in the district, she just barely won her reelection.
Well, that's the thing too. You need to be in a district that's fairly safe, because you're going to be taking votes that are going to be uncomfortable for you, yeah. or you're going to be doing things, and that's why you need someone in a safe district to be the leader. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. You know, at this point, it looks like the minority leader of the House is going to be Hakeem Jeffries.
And for the next few decades, he'll be the speaker and leader. Mm. Yeah. Oh, great.
Yes, I know. I'm getting Hoyer's from Maryland, not Delaware. Yes, apologies. All right. We're going to read a couple of words from our sponsors, and then we will have Kate Aronoff with us from the New Republic to talk about COP27. First off, not a sponsor, but we have an opportunity today to match for you. It's Giving Tuesday, and we had somebody on from GiveDirectly the other day. I really like this charity. And I like this charity for two reasons. One, because it is incredibly effective, and a huge percentage of your every dollar you give goes literally to people living in extreme poverty. They have a very small administrative fee. You can check that out on something like Charity Navigator. That's what you should look for generally with a charity, that they're for every dollar, close to 90% of that dollar goes or more goes to the recipients of the charity as opposed to the administration. The other reason why I really like this charity, as we talked about the other day, is that it shows a model that can be used in public policy going forward, where you can see things like child tax credit payments. These aren't really credits. They're basically just payments. We just call them child tax credits because we're afraid to call them allowance, essentially. Got 40% of children who are living in poverty out of poverty during that period of time that we were doing that. Any examples that exist, whether they are done through charitable organizations or pilot programs by the government or by cities or wherever, that show the most effective way to deal with poverty is to put money in the hands of people living in poverty directly. And that's why I really like this charity. So if you go to our YouTube link or our podcast link or the Majority Report page, you'll see a link to Give Directly. You can go to givedirectly.org. They are matching funds today. So if you give $10, it's like giving $20. If you give up to $10,000, it's like giving $20,000. And so check that out. Give Directly. That is not a paid sponsorship. It is just we got that opportunity, and I wanted to point it out to you. So
great.
Suck it. I don't know what to tell.
In your face.
In your face. People who don't, for whatever reason, wouldn't want me to do that. Paid sponsor, but also a product that I use, Aura. I went when we got Aura as a sponsor, or when I was checking them out before we did, I inputted a couple of my emails. I use separate emails for different accounts, and bingo bango, I get back and it tells me how many times that email and the passwords associated have been compromised on the dark web, and you can do that too, not just for yourself, but also for your family. Aura helps fight back against those annoying websites that make your personal information public by automatically requesting removal of your info. This helps reduce robocalls. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers, like I say, by scanning the dark web where criminals sell stolen information. So you can look for your family's emails, passwords, social security numbers, your kids as well, and it alerts you fast. If you find anything, or gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if someone's trying to opening a loan or a credit card in your name. I got a ping when I opened up a savings account for Mila. because she's too young to get her own. So it was under my auspices, as it were. And I got a little ping on that. Aura's VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. Aura protects your devices from viruses, malware, spyware, so the bad guys can't break in. Aura helps you manage what your kids do on their devices. Which, if your kids are like my kids, makes them rather upset. You can restrict specific apps, set screen time limits, and even set focus time to ensure your child is doing their homework instead of binging YouTube. But it's nice not to have to be looking over their shoulder. Aura's password manager lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. You can try Aura for free for 14 days at aura.com/majority. You're going to be shocked how much of your private information Aura finds exposed online over the next 2 weeks during your free trial. And you take action. That's aura.com/majority. Aura.com/majority to try Aura for free for 14 days. And lastly, a longtime listener of the program owns a, or I should say, is part of a leftist-owned worker collective. It is called IAC Laser Engraving. Ryan Lubin started this thing in September of 2021. His company is democratically structured, ensures that any hierarchies are completely justified and efficient. They use sustainably sourced materials coupled with extremely energy-efficient laser technology to bring you unique products that you will not find anywhere else and make amazing gifts. Your purchase of their items not only gets you a one-of-a-kind product, it also goes directly to supporting a business model that is structured around compassionate and worker-centered care as opposed to the more traditional and predatory authoritarian ones found throughout our capitalist system. Check this out. I've showed you guys the photo frames before. I've showed you guys the puzzles. I'll talk about the puzzles in a second, but this is a what do you call it? Sasquatch?
Sasquatch.
Yeah,
Sasquatch.
And it's got a bunch of mini Bigfoot. Sasquatch in it. It's a Bigfoot. It is, I don't know how many layers we're talking. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 layers of wood that has been cut out with a laser, incredibly precise. And there it is. Now, I should say, just so that people don't freak out, this is not a real Sasquatch. This is made out of wood. If you hang this in your house, it is not going to walk away because it's not a real Sasquatch.
Right.
It might summon one, though.
It might ward them off, though. Well,
we're not going to make any claims to that at all.
Well, yeah.
But this thing is amazing. This, honestly, like, I wouldn't put it outside because I have a feeling it's not, although you could probably shellac it.
Probably scare the birds away.
Would, yes, around your grapes. Look at this owl. It's nuts. Now, they have this in two different sizes. I think the Sasquatch also comes in two different sizes. But the detail here is amazing. It's got 6 different layers, I think. Maybe actually 8 now that I see it, or 9. And it's gorgeous. Has you can hang it on the wall. As you can see, they have it built in there. It's super easy to do. This is just another example of one of the gifts they have. And then you remember the astronaut that Saul will be getting as a – we may have to take a picture of this. Saul will be getting this as a Hanukkah gift.
It's very cool.
And they have puzzles, and these are great too, actually. Puzzles that you with beautiful photos, or you can have a custom made one from your own photo. It comes in a beautiful wooden box. Just all sorts of great, beautiful gifts that are really, honestly, one of a kind. They use, you know, UV protection to UV printer to print the pictures on the wood. I mean, it's just gorgeous. Go check it out. You can visit IACLasers.com to order yours today. Enter in the coupon code MAJORITY10. At time of purchase, you'll get a 10% discount on their amazing products. Remember, they have custom family or personal photos that can be made into wooden puzzles for an additional fee. That is, you know, obviously the custom ones are a little more expensive, but totally worth it. Check it out. Great gifts, and tis the season. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kate Aronoff. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, staff writer with the New Republic, Kate Aronoff. Kate, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back.
So COP27, did you head out to Egypt for coverage of this, or were you following it from afar?
I was following from afar, which meant my sleep schedule has been really stellar for the last little while, given that the COP was in Egypt.
I imagine it takes a while to get reoriented to our time here. All right, let's start with one of the first things I saw coming out of COP27. Well, why don't you actually back up? Why don't you tell us what is COP27? Why is it called COP? And is it? I assume it's the 27th one.
I have I write this out for almost every article I've ever written about a COP, and so very happy to explain. So COP stands for Conference of Parties, and that's the Conference of Parties, which are nations to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And so COP are annual gatherings of the parties to discuss how to implement various things, including the Paris Agreement, which is what folks were discussing this year.
One of the things that I had seen come out of COP before we get into the stuff that you had written about was increase in fossil fuel lobbyists who are actually in attendance. Is that a good sign or is that a bad sign? I mean, because I would imagine it means like they're concerned that something's going to happen there. And so I take that as a good sign.
Because normally they would operate in the shadows, probably, right, as a way to just make it seem a little less gross. Now they're out there publicly. I don't know.
It's interesting. There were more as you're saying. There are more fossil fuel delegates this year than there have been in past years. But it's been a long-standing theme, almost going back the entire history of the UNFCCC for fossil fuel representatives to be sort of floating around. And they come in different forms. I mean, the sort of count of fossil fuel lobbyists includes both private companies, so people who work for a Shell or a BP who can attend as observers, the only people who can actually negotiate over the terms of the texts that are being discussed at COPs are national delegates, right? So people who are with their governments, but fossil fuel executives and their apparatchiks can sort of attend as observers to these processes, be in negotiating rooms, for instance, and certainly be talking to delegates and national negotiators on the side. And that also includes the sort of count of fossil fuel representatives also includes representatives from fossil fuel exporting states. So, you know, the likes of Saudi Arabia, several Gulf oil states, are sort of thought of to be in that vicinity because they are on some level representing the interest of the fossil fuel industry, just of the state-owned variety rather than the privately owned variety that we get in the United States.
So, I mean, do I have that right that it may indicate that they're afraid that stuff is actually happening? Because I presume what they do is they sit in the room and they go, oh, wait a second, what's that guy from country X? They sound like they're taking this seriously. After we're done with the session, I've got to go up to them and take them out to lunch and offer them some type of, we've got a big contract that we want to do offshore from you or something. That, like, I mean, they're there because they're afraid that there's going to be activity that is not in their best interest. So at the very least, I mean, their presence ends up, I would imagine, not necessarily being helpful in the long run, but it's indicative of at least some potential for positive things from our perspective happening.
It's a sign that they're under pressure. Yes. And that is why they attend, but their influence in the process, I think is worth just sort of getting into the nuances of it a little bit. And so the place traditionally where a lot of fossil fuel companies have intervened is around something known as Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which is broadly meant to deal with mitigation, mostly mitigation coordination among various countries. Mostly that means carbon markets. And that has been a huge focus for fossil fuel companies for the last several years. The International Emissions Trading Association is usually within COP conferences, their sort of little corner. They'll have a pavilion alongside all the national pavilions, host these talks about wanting to ensure the integrity of carbon markets. So that's been their point of intervention. And then as you know, saw this year, they also will kind of weigh in on questions about fossil fuel phase outs, for instance. But I think they're, you know, part of the kind of water of these discussions and are kind of core to like what gets talked about, right? It's not as if they come in and sort of disrupt necessarily this process that is otherwise proceeding at pace. They are, they are talking very extensively with national governments sort of year round. They have a very deep role, and there is no conflict of interest policy at the UNFCCC. And so they are free to sort of just walk around, talking with governments, and there's no sort of, I think for a lot of people attending COPs, including as negotiators, it's normal that they would be there, right? And you even have sort of stalwarts of the process suggesting they should have a more elevated role given their importance to the energy transition, as, you know, for instance, being allowed to negotiate, for instance, Cristina Figueres, who, you know, is great on many fronts, suggested, was a sort of driving force behind the Paris Agreement, suggested that fossil fuel companies should, you know, be not excluded from the process in the way that they complain about.
Is the theory behind that like, they're either going to impede this process or they're going to be a part of it. And if we can figure out, I mean, I remember Chris Hayes once discussing the ACA as sort of like protection money on some level. Like we're basically saying like, you know, let us do this and, we'll pay you some money essentially to the insurance companies. Like let us provide insurance for more people and better insurance, and we'll make sure that it we grease your pocket, you get to wet your beak type of situation. Like, is that sort of the attitude here? Like, they're not going away. They have a tremendous amount of resources. It's not like the people who are attending this these particular conferences have the legislative power necessarily back home domestically to disempower these people. So they're left with one of two choices. Either they're, you know, inside the tent pissing out or outside the tent pissing in, I guess.
Yeah, and their role this year, I think, is even more important than it was at COP26 in Glasgow last year, which were bigger talks, right? These were, more robustly attended. There were more outcomes that people were looking forward to. But we've, of course, in the last year had Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, which has been a big boost to U.S. fossil fuel companies. And in Europe, you have countries going out and trying to ink deals with countries like Qatar, with Egypt for gas deals, really just to meet these short-term demands as a result of Russia, cutting off the taps, basically. And so I think the gas companies in particular really came into COP feeling their oats a little bit more than they would have been in Glasgow. And for a lot of countries, I mean, they just see this as a sort of natural part of the process. They don't see, even in the United States, any sort of contradiction between the fossil fuel industry continuing to extract, even boosting production, and meeting our goals on climate, which is wrong, but is a sort of consensus among a lot of elite policymakers.
Was there, in terms of like the Russian invasion of Ukraine, did that in any way speed up, accelerate both investment or even sort of like thinking in terms of like, we've really got to find alternate sources more, or are we already at that point? And it's just a question of like, I don't know, increased will to push that process along.
I think in Europe, it's been a lot more pronounced than in the U.S., where you almost immediately saw the American Petroleum Institute saying, well, Russia invaded Ukraine. That's why we need to build more pipelines, just sort of pushing the things they've been pushing for many years. In Europe, it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, almost immediately, you also saw countries trying to ink contracts for new gas infrastructure, in particular, seeking out contracts with other countries to import large amounts of gas, and I mean methane gas, not gasoline. That's a little confusing the way that we talk about it in the United States. But on the other hand, you did see more of a push for electrification, for decarbonization in the long term. But I think you do have this sort of tension in Europe in particular, and that they have pretty real sort of short-term supply constraints in terms of how people are going to heat their homes, around costs for energy, for home heating in particular, right? But they still, I think, in the long term, are looking toward a transition, have not totally forsaken that. But the open question is how short term some of this new infrastructure the Europeans are bringing online will be, and will they actually shut that down in time to meet climate goals, or will it lock in a sort of new generation of fossil fuel infrastructure that will keep polluting well beyond when we need to have been off of coal, oil, and gas?
From the U.S.'s perspective, like, I guess, what are some of the concessions that they seem more open to giving? And what are some of the red lines that, not just in this negotiation period, but throughout the history of COP, that maybe the U.S. has been very reluctant to go down that road in terms of climate change mitigation?
Yeah, the big story of this COP was around something known as loss and damage, which essentially means funds to help particularly developing countries, which is a big group, to recover from climate-fueled disasters. And that's historically been a very, very firm red line for the U.S., the idea of establishing a dedicated fund for loss and damage, because as they see it, and, you know, not just the U.S., but Europeans as well and other wealthy countries are very concerned about the idea that they would be made to compensate poorer countries for the damages that their historical emissions have caused, right? And so these particular words, liability and compensation, have been the big sort of sticking point, particularly for the U.S. and for other wealthy countries, and were, you know, sort of made, taken out of the process, essentially, these particular concepts of liability and compensation. Even then, and that happened, you know, the Paris Agreement sort of made clear that that would not be how loss and damage funds were distributed, that it would not be an issue of liability and compensation. But even so, the U.S., really until the final hours of COP27 this year, had been adamantly opposed to the idea of even creating a fund for loss and damage in the way that there already are existing funds under the UN auspices for mitigation and adaptation.
So did they finally relent?
Yes.
And okay, so my understanding is that the that there was almost like a statutory, or maybe it was just a resolution, I guess, from the late 90s, Bert Hagel, I think it was, and it was an attempt to keep us out of the Kyoto protocols, which a successful attempt, which and the Kyoto protocols were sort of a version of the Paris Accords, for lack of better understanding on my part. What we were adamant about not getting in late 90s, Al Gore was wearing all sorts of earth tones and no one believed him. Maureen Dowd was making fun of him. And so we didn't do that. And among other things, what that resolution existed out there. That was not binding, I guess. How is it that you go to like day 12 of COP27 30 years later, 25 years later, and you go, you know what, actually, we will do that. Like what happened, and how big of a fund is it, and how important is this? I mean, because if we're on the hook to pay for, you know, sort of mitigation or really in some ways reparations, right? And it's like almost like pre-reparations. That indicates at least a deeper commitment to stopping it because we're on the hook to pay for the implications of it.
So, yes. So just to back up a little bit. No. This is great. And just to give a little bit of the sort of capsule history of the U.S. in the UNFCCC process and the Byrd-Hagel resolution that you mentioned. So, as you said, the Kyoto protocols were a sort of earlier round of climate talks of a climate agreement, right? And so before countries went to Kyoto to negotiate that pact, the Senate almost unanimously voted not to join, basically said we will not ratify anything that commits us as wealthy countries to compensating developing countries for climate the result of our own pollution, right? And it, you know, was non-binding, but essentially meant was a statement of intent to not ratify the Kyoto Protocol, which Clinton ended up signing on to, right? The Clinton White House ended up supporting that, even knowing that it wouldn't be ratified. Bush ends up pulling the U.S. out. And what that does is essentially send the international community back to the drawing board. The Kyoto Protocol still exists. There's still negotiations that go on at COP around them for the countries that are still a party to them. But obviously, you want the world's largest economy involved in an international agreement to deal with climate change. And so that's where we get the Paris Agreement, right? So if the Kyoto Protocol was structured based on this division between Annex 1 and Annex 2 countries, Annex 1 countries being, roughly speaking, the sort of wealthy world, mostly Western countries, Annex 2 meaning sort of developing countries, now basically the G77 plus China. The Paris Agreement is what's known as a bottom-up process. And so the way that agreement is structured is that every single country comes together with their own pledges for how they're going to reduce emissions in line with the goals of the Paris Agreement. And that is really the sort of substance of how those emissions reductions happen, which really levels the playing field to require that every country and not just the sort of wealthiest ones, as was the case in the Kyoto Protocol, contribute toward emissions reductions. And the U.S. fought very hard as the Paris Agreement was being negotiated to get rid of any sort of reference to liability and compensation. And so it really had not been even something that G77 negotiators who were pushing a loss and damage fund were talking about to require any semblance of reparations per se. That was not sort of language that has been used in negotiating rooms for a long time. And they did sort of harp on what is baked into the UNFCCC and into the conventions themselves, which is this concept of common but differentiated responsibility, right? The idea that some countries have a larger capacity to contribute to dealing with climate change on mitigation, adaptation, and loss and damage than others. And so that was sort of the way that this case was pushed, not really the language of reparations, not the language of liability and compensation. And the G77 was really united in a way that it rarely is in pushing for this fund to be established. And so it was, you know, many people that I spoke to were surprised that this loss and damage fund ended up getting written into the final text because the U.S. opposition has been so consistent, including until the final hours, like Friday night was when that change happened. And up until, you know, even Thursday, the official line from the U.S. had been, we will not support a fund for loss and damage. We'll talk about it. We'll think about funding arrangements. But that specific ask, which the G77 and China had been pushing for, you know, for many, many years, that, you know, still seemed to be a red line until the final hours. And you know, people that I've talked to said it's just, we're still sort of trying to wrap their heads around it. We're genuinely surprised that the U.S. relented on this, but was a result of years and years of pressure, mainly from developing countries and civil society, to get this put in place.
I mean, I'm very happy about it, and I assume none of the details necessarily worked out. It was agreed to in principle, and so the idea is that there's some broad parameters, and negotiators will go ahead now, I imagine, and meet over the next couple of months and start to hammer this out in time for next year, or is that basically the way it works?
Yeah, so there's no money behind it now, right?
It's just the general concept of from each according to his ability. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's what it sort of sounds like a little bit.
Well, that's my question really, is that in terms of the money, right, is that what is driving the U.S. opposition to this, in the sense that, like, do they feel like there's going to be domestic pushback, just back to kind of the earlier part of our conversation, that's going to make it impossible for their, I mean, besides the obvious reason, like, they don't want to pay. I mean, I understand that, but... Do they feel that politically it sets up a fight for them domestically at home, maybe with, like, say, the Republicans, for specifically the Biden administration?
I think that's been a big part of the opposition. And again, I mean, Bert Hagel looms over all of this and not making the U.S. pay. But what was actually agreed to in Sharm el-Sheikh, where the talks were held, didn't even get to that level of detail, right? The idea is to establish a fund as part of a broad array of financial arrangements. And so the U.S. isn't actually on the hook to put money into this in any sort of binding way, in the same way that they're not, you know, on any sort of legal hook to put money into the Green Climate Fund for mitigation or the Adaptation Fund for adaptation, obviously. So there's no sort of idea that the U.S. will be made to, like, pony up all this money, but still, right, you have, like, the Wall Street Journal in the days after, during COP and immediately after, saying, you know, Biden signs up for reparations, which is not true. It's just, like, not an accurate reading of anything that was talked about.
It's a step in the right direction. There's a lot of work to be done. Is part of this, I guess I just have this sort of, like, you know, mind frame of, when we do something like this and there's this type of change, it doesn't come out of nowhere, and it's not just a function of lobbyists. And I'm thinking back to, like, you know, a lot of people attribute to progress in civil rights in this country, in terms of, like, the Voting Rights Act, in terms of, like, the Civil Rights Act, to pressure to compete with the Soviet Union on some level, to show that we were, you know, a democracy. And this is one of the things in the democracy. How much of this is, like, China is out there. They have been, developing parts of Africa, providing funds for infrastructure and this and that for years and years, actually, much more so than we have. I don't know what kind of strings are associated with that necessarily. But how much of this was, like, people looking at us and, like a growing sense in this country that China is a rival of ours, and that we need to step up in these instances so that these developing countries do not see China as the only, benevolent source of reparations?
I think it's part of it, right? I mean, I think, you know, obviously, sort of U.S. competition with China colors a lot about how these sorts of diplomatic efforts go. I wouldn't say it's the primary reason. I mean, to talk to people who were at the negotiations and in rooms with the U.S. delegation and with John Kerry, the International Climate Envoy, the sense you get is that they were really sort of angry about being the bad guys of these talks. And, you know, partly based on what these talks were, this was an implementation COP. There were not other, you know, major outcomes that were expected besides loss and damage and on Article 6. And there was just a ton of pressure put on the U.S. And I think you saw really the mainstreaming of a line that I've heard from civil society groups, from, you know, folks from the Global South who've been attending these talks for a long time, that the U.S. has been one of the main obstructionary forces in these processes, has been the barrier to getting more done on climate change on many fronts. And you know, I think that really sunk in for a lot of the U.S. negotiating team this year. And, you know, they got concessions, certainly. They, you know, sort of watered down the language of what this fund might look like, left open a lot of room where they can intervene in the coming months as the details are being worked out. But, you know, I think it is really a story of pressure from below being put on them, and they didn't want to do it. Like, they really didn't want to do it. And it's, that's, you know, both things that happened in the 2 weeks at COP, but also, you know, going back as long as the UNFCCC process has been around, right? In the early 90s, like, small island states started asking for this, right? And so that's been the whole sort of a really main theme of these negotiations has been climate vulnerable countries pushing for loss and damage funds, and it worked. It's a I think it's a really rare, inspiring story in the on this beat of pressure, you know, kind of really working.
All right, one more final question, and I also have to compliment myself for not making a comment about John Kerry worrying about like beach erosion in Nantucket as also a sort of something that inspired
me. I mean, good thing you didn't make that comment.
Exactly, exactly. I didn't. Final question. How damaging is it when we don't sign on to the Kyoto Accords, or when Bush pulls out, you know, after Clinton has like tried to sort of like, I'll put it in play and hopefully there'll be a more amenable Senate, you know, after I go, or and then Trump comes and pulls us out of the Paris Accords. I mean, we're, you know, back in, but how much does this, like, how much does it freeze everything, like, and start the clock again? Like, how much, like, material damage does it do to this process to get us to where, remotely close to where we need to be?
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard counterfactual to answer for a lot of reasons, right? I mean, the UNFCCC does not have power, right? It does not control a lot of money. It is not the IMF. It is not the World Bank. I think why this matters, right, is that we waited, you know, decades longer than we needed to, in large part because of the U.S., not exclusively, to have an international agreement on how to deal with climate change. Who's to say, right, how much more progress could have been made over the last 30 years if the U.S. had gotten in the way, if Senate math had looked different, if there hadn't been this unanimous resolution that chilled a lot of action here. You know, and I think I am not really in the business of counterfactuals, but I think it's fair to say that a lot more could have been done. We, you know, might be seeing fewer climate disasters now, potentially, even if that process had been allowed to proceed. But I think really, you know, the U.S., how the U.S. behaves in the UN is really indicative of how it behaves in a lot of other international institutions, right? And so if there had been more room given on debt relief at the IMF, if the U.S. had pushed for to you know, not have these punishing structural adjustment arrangements, had not you know, had supported reform at the Bretton Woods institutions that were in line with the 21st century, that really put climate at the top of the agenda, that might have been, you know, an even bigger boon for the climate than having an agreement 20 years ago. But the U.S. is its own sort of beast when it comes to these sorts of diplomatic arrangements. And we're very, very reluctant on many, many fronts to, you know, be collaborative in any sort of genuine way, and really do push a pretty narrow set of U.S. interests onto the rest of the world. And so I think that, you know, more so even than like had the Kyoto Protocol process gone forward, if that were sort of the regime we were under now, you know, it's, I think that's hard to answer, but, you know, I think the U.S. has a really big responsibility, given its sort of outsized importance in the, you know, international financial architecture, in the world system, just by virtue of being the largest economy, that has certainly really stalled action, besides, you know, obviously what we emit as the world's largest oil exporter and a major emitter in our own right.
Kate Aronoff, staff writer, New Republic. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
Thanks. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jonah Furman from Labor Notes, author of Who Gets the Bird, the newsletter on Substack, and we'll be here to talk about the potentially impending railroad strike and maybe give us an update on what's happening, University of California, 48,000 folks on strike out there. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Jonah Furman. He is from Labor Notes, author of Who Gets the Bird? It's a newsletter on Substack. You can check that out via Substack. Jonah, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So we are getting very close to the end of the, I think this is the second cooling off period that has been issued by, I believe, the Department of Labor, wherein the parties, there are 12 unions, if I'm not mistaken, railroad unions that that are in negotiations with seven major carriers. This is freight railroads, and they offered a contract. And now it's been rejected. First off, just under what auspices do these cooling off periods happen? Just remind everybody. I know you mentioned this last time you were on, but this is important for people to know that railroads have a very distinct status, I guess, in terms of labor law in this country. Just walk us through that, and then let's pick up from where we are.
Right. So the railroads and actually the airlines are covered under the RLA, the Railway Labor Act. And this is an act that predates legal unionism in this country. It was because in the late 19th century and early 20th century, there was such massive strike activity, so much disruption on the rails, and it was so crucial at that time before mass trucking and things like that, that Congress was like, okay, we don't do anything with unions. We don't recognize unions for the most part, but the rails are so important, we need to stabilize labor relations here. So in 1926, they passed the Railway Labor Act. So then when they do the New Deal era labor stuff, which is the normal private sector labor law, the railways are already covered. They're covered under a separate regime, and it has the hallmarks of just it's just much more bureaucratic, much slower, much more federal government involvement, and doesn't have like a right that as many rights for the workers to exercise, sort of hash it out in the private sector. There's a lot more government involvement. So anything happening on the railroads are covered under this RLA, which gives a bunch of hoops that you have to jump through before strike activity is legal, basically.
Okay. And I should say, to be fair, conservatives and libertarians have been up in arms in this for over 100 years. This
big
interference in the right of people to associate and to create entities and to enter into the marketplace in this way that they deem appropriate. They are so upset about this because it is such an infringement upon the freedom of contract and everything else. That is why you hear the hue and cry constantly. Of course, I'm joking. It is, people should understand that any statutes that have involved unions have restricted their power, as opposed to allowing for people to organize as unions and restrictive. I mean, I guess there are, and not really, they're restrictive by any means that you want, I guess. So people should be aware of that. That said, that has been the law of the land for over almost 100 years in terms of the railways and ultimately the airlines. And I guess a little bit 80 years since like the Taft-Hartley. So that's where we're at. The Labor Department calls for the cooling off period. We're at the end of it. tell us what the status is of this, of the contract negotiations.
Yeah, the status is, so these cooling off periods are basically periods in which any strike or lockout, they use this ancient term self-help, but basically means a strike or lockout is illegal under federal law. So you have to wait until these various periods expire before you can, if you're the union, call a strike that's going to be legal and you're not liable for extra, you know, extremely destructive penalties, or if you're the employer, before you can legally lock workers out, basically meaning you can't come to work because we don't have a deal. So the cooling off period stuff is very complicated, but essentially when certain events happen, it triggers new cooling off periods. So if you reach a tentative agreement with the employer, then, you know, you have another cooling off period. Also, the unions voluntarily extended and changed their cooling off period. Essentially, it's this game of chicken where they're saying, like, here's our deadline. If we don't have a deal by then, we're going to strike. They get closer to that deadline. They feel, oh, maybe we should settle for, you know, send something to the members to vote up or down. So where we got is that next week is really the final boss of the cooling off periods. The unions that have not settled are not going to settle. There's not much negotiation happening between the employers and the unions at this point. And four remaining unions that represent a majority of the railroad workers. So there's 12 unions here, but you're talking about the big, basically the biggest chunk, says we don't have a deal. And if we reach December 9th, we're going to walk off the job. Now, the RLA, the Railway Labor Act, basically provides for Congress to intervene. It's understood that Congress can intervene and say they can pass whatever law they want. They say you have to legally go back to work under these terms. They could say there's a new cooling off period. They have free rein to say, but it's sort of past practice is that they will intervene. The last time we saw a national rail strike was in 1992. In which actually Joe Biden voted against sending the workers back to work. But we had, you know, something like 24 hours, 36 hours of strike. Congress passed a law that I think that time around sent them back into forced arbitration, but essentially just said, you're going back to work, you're getting another deal. So Congress can do whatever it wants. And the question was, are they going to, A, stay out of it, which was, you know, one version that the unions would have been all right with, basically saying, sure, go settle it yourself, just like any other private sector issue, like the John Deere strike, like other big strikes we've seen. You go strike, the employer decides how much hurt they can take financially, and hopefully they come to the table. That's what it's supposed to be. The second option is Congress steps in a way that is, you know, they're basically writing a union contract through federal legislation, which is totally strange, but this is how the Railway Labor Act works. You're expected to step in and say, the strike's over and here's the contract. And you can write whatever you want in there. Now, what happens here is yesterday the White House came out with a statement saying, we are going to pass a bill saying you can't strike and here's your deal. And the deal is the deal that these four unions have rejected. So the members voted. Now, how this works is essentially you negotiate an agreement between the leadership of the unions and the employers, so representatives of the employers, right? So you don't have Warren Buffett, but you have Warren Buffett's guy sitting there, and you have the union's guy sitting there. They come to a deal, and then the unions, because they are democratic institutions, they send it to the members for a vote. And this stuff, you know, different unions have different rules, but essentially you send it out to literally working people who will have to live under this agreement, and they say, yes or no, do you want it? Some of the unions said, yes, we'll take this deal. But the majority of the workers covered said, no, we're not going to take the deal. And the White House says in the statement that Biden put out yesterday, you know, we hate to intervene in a contract vote of the membership, but we're going to intervene in a contract vote of the membership. And what's extra crazy about it, just to frame it, is that this issue that they're facing is mostly about paid sick days. You talk to these workers, if you're in touch with them, the flagship issue is paid sick days, 3, 5, 7, 15. There's different numbers people will say. There's other issues too. But the amount of money it would cost for the paid sick days for the railroads is something like 3% of their annual profits. These are monopolistic companies making billions, billions of dollars. So there's not an economic question here. You know, there's some strikes historically where you're like, man, the workers want this and the company's going to go bankrupt if they get it. What are we going to do? How do we handle this? But on all sides, this would be totally livable. Like the companies could live with it. Freight service would be fine. It would probably get better. It's really bad right now because of understaffing and cuts. So it's just interesting to me that there's no economic question here. There's just a question of power.
I want to ask about and we should also say we're talking about 115,000, if I'm not mistaken, workers in total, 70,000 who are represented by four of these unions. That,
like a little maybe it's like 65. Okay. Yeah, it's something
somewhere
like
around there. Mm-hmm. And you know, from your reporting and other reporting, it really does seem that it's a question of paid sick leave. And, you know, one of the things I like to do is listen to the AP news in the morning just to get a sense of like how stories like this are being communicated. And of course, it's the railways have given raises, a 23% raise to and the context, it seems to me, is the context is they slashed employees over the past like 5-10 years, right? Like the number of employees that have been working on freight rail have gone down dramatically. And so I wonder if the paid sick leave, I mean, it could just be like, we don't want to lose or if it's also a function of, if we offer paid sick leave, there's some actuarial somewhere in the building going like, we're going to have to hire more workers because, you know, people are sick. They stay on the job because they can't afford to lose the pay. And we need, if we anticipate, you know, I don't know, 600,000 work days a year, you know, because we have 115,000 workers, we anticipate 600,000 work days missed a year because of they're going to be sick. And you know these workers, they'll take off as many paid sick days as you give. I mean, I got Bradley just walked out of here today. But they're thinking we're going to have to hire another 5,000 workers or whatever it is. And I can't help but think every time I hear about firing or hiring workers, the only thing that like resonates in my brain is somebody in the C-suite has their stock options that are tied to a certain profit margin that is always a function of labor. And if we can cut labor hours, we're going to raise that profit margin.
And they've been successful at that. It's record profits, by the way.
In terms of profits for the company, it's less relevant than certain benchmarks that the CFO or the CEO or the COO is sitting there going like, this is $1 million bonus to me if we give these work days. That's what I hear. Is there any, how wrong am I about that?
You're totally right. The thing I would pull out here is it's actually more absurd for the railways because the railroads have been cutting, like you said, they've cut something like 30% of their workforce in the past 6 years. Since the year 2000, I think they've cut 50,000 out of 170,000 workers that once were there. And part of what's happening is there, I mean, a little bit of automation, other tightening they're doing, but they can also just go as low as they want in terms of service because these are monopolies. There's several of them, but they all cover separate areas. So if you're a company that has to ship on the rails because you're going from point A to point B with heavy freight you're trying to ship, you don't get to choose, I'm going to go CSX instead of Union Pacific, or I'm going to go BNSF instead of Norfolk, you know, or whatever. Like there's not the option. They are geographic monopolies, which means that they can cut service as much as they want. And there's no way out. They've fully captured the market. So when you talk about how can they just, you know, they want to make more money by cutting labor, but at some point won't their bottom line suffer? The answer is basically no. I mean, there's not really a bottom for service droppage in this. Because if you're a company that you're in the business of shipping freight across the country, most companies can't just switch from we were doing it on rail and now we do it on freight. What, right. We're going to fly stuff across the country. We're going to build a new canal. There's not another option there. So they can just cut and cut and cut. And they just realize that there's really not going to be any fallout for that. And if you look at, you know, Surface Transportation Board hearings over the past couple of years and congressional hearings, there's all this talk of, you know, I mean, we saw like last week, the National Chemical Distributors came out and said, we really need to get these rail workers sick days because the rails are so inefficient at this point at moving important materials around the country that we have to fix the industry and you have to stop shedding workers. Part of that is, you know, having a job that can attract and retain people. Part of it is literally just stop shedding.
Firing people.
Yes, you're laying them off. And they're looking for, you know, I mean, there's some more math to it. They would love to get old timers out of there, people who have pension obligations that they have to deal with. You know, there's stories of, there's railroads right now that are offering like a $20,000 signing bonus to new, cheaper employees that they then bring on for 6 months and assume that they will quit after that. So they're just moving to this high churn model from what are multi-generation jobs. I mean, you have communities in North Dakota where you have fifth generation railroad workers, and this is how you live. You know, this is the only game in town. So it's really even worse than what you're saying because they're monopolies.
And we should say that there's also a very strong argument that a lot of our inflationary pressures have been a function of this as well, because you can't just find new truck drivers. There's not just like a fleet of trucks that is just sitting somewhere waiting for, you know, the training that involves these truck drivers. A lot of people don't want to go into truck driving because that's also been a crap show for years, frankly. And I don't know. This is one of those things where it's like, if we thought it was important enough to pass a law to restrict the ability of labor to exercise their power, then maybe it's important enough for us to pass a law that restricts and I'm sure we have the antitrust authority right now to basically say, like, we're not going to allow for these type of monopolies. I say we take the whole damn thing over. The U.S. government is more than capable, it seems to me, of ownership stake in these trains. So there we go.
Yeah, and just like if we can bring it back really quickly to the Biden administration, I know you have to go at some point, Jonah. But back to Pelosi and Schumer seem to be in lockstep on this. They have said that they're going to work together to craft this contract, which you're saying is essentially going to be a copy of the initial agreement, which they ended up rejecting, which only includes one sick day. I mean, for the most part, they're asking for, you say it varies from union to union, but like to force a contract on to these over 100,000 rail workers is really just fairly like despicable, because it seems like the Biden administration is fearful about a strike and how that would affect the supply chain. Is there a sense from the union's perspective that there are enough progressives in the House that might be able to hold this up and say, stop this from passing? Or will there be enough Republicans in the lame duck that would join? I mean, from my perspective, it seems like Republicans might not want to break rank at all, because if there's a strike shutdown, maybe they see that as a help for them. Will there be progressives that might hold the line in favor of labor, just like being able to do their negotiations and Congress can step away?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, whether members of Congress are willing to buck the White House and buck the Democratic Party leadership and say, we have to insist on a deal. There's been a few people today who have come out and said, you know, maybe not, I won't vote for this, but we definitely need to figure out how to get paid sick days for these workers. Now, the worry is that they're like, okay, we'll do a separate bill over there. But the whole way this works is that the rail workers have national attention now because of their strike threat. This is the whole point. This is why you strike, is you create leverage around key moments and key choke points in the economy. So if we just kick it to another bill or another reform, great, but it's not going to pass. I mean, Congress is not in the business of passing legislation. Now, they can be when there's an emergency. I don't think, honestly, I don't know that there's enough progressives who are going to have the spine to stand up and say, no, we have to have a deal with paid sick days. And I also just would say, talking to a lot of rail workers, the unions are, you know, the union leadership has a lot to answer for here. And there's a lot of members who are upset about how the leadership played this too. The fact is, these unions are scared to exercise some of this power. They kept moving their strike deadlines because they know that they don't have support in the Democratic Party. So they're looking around and feeling isolated and scared to do what needs to be done. And the only ones who are really fired up and ready to run with it are the members. That's why they keep rejecting agreements. But, you know,
and it disempowers the unions themselves to have the leadership vote for it, because it makes the members seem like they're being unreasonable because the leadership voted for it. Well, I guess we'll have a better sense of this over the next couple of days, really. And because the deadline is the 9th, We're 10 days away from that. Jonah, thanks for updating us. Folks can follow your work at Labor Notes and, of course, on your Substack at Who Gets the Bird. But we'd love to have you back in a couple of weeks and find out what's going on with this. Jonah Furman, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
All right, folks. We went late. I don't know why. I don't know what happened. But we did.
We did.
What are you going to
do? Never
two
happens.
Important topics. So.
Yep. Folks, just a reminder, your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, but you also get the free half free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. And then you get searchability on the app. You can IM the show via the app. That's one of the membership perks. You can IM the show and mock us.
Call Sam a boomer.
Call me a boomer in print, not just at your computer.
That's slander versus libel.
Exactly. And we'll see. Also, don't worry. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Emma, what's happening on ESPN?
YouTube.com/ESPN show. That's where the show will live going forward. We talked about Jerry Jones's photograph.
The Forrest Gump moment for Jerry Jones.
I know. Oh, he just showed up at the mob that was opposing integration in Little Rock. He didn't know what was going
on. All these Jim Crow flashpoints. You look closely into the background of the photo.
Yeah, it is. It is like a racist Forrest Gump situation. Stephen A. Smith going on to defend him kind of shows that is more class solidarity than anything, because he's kept talking about cancellation. We dove into that as well as just a recap of the
poor
NFL
Jerry Jones.
Well.
People are trying to cancel him.
I know. He at one point, Stephen A. says that they were looking to eradicate him.
Yeah, eradication is a fun word to use in the context.
Yeah,
of
and
that.
By the way, nothing's going to happen to him, and he'll still own the Dallas Cowboys and be a billionaire. So that and actual football we discussed for a long period of
eradicate,
time. YouTube.com.
Eradicate Jerry Jones like he eradicates blackhead coaches from his searches.
One of them, what? Never hired one. Never hired one.
Just a coincidence.
Yep.
Hey, he's just trying to hire the most.
Qualified people. That's also why he donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund. So
yeah, the best people.
The best.
The
biggest also inauguration. Don't forget.
Was Jerry in the crowd there?
Jerry, you're getting a lot of crowds. Why don't you show up at that crowd? on Left Reckoning tonight, Sam Goodman of La Ruta de Clima talking about COP and this whole lost damage of victory, as well as some other things that need to be done in terms of climate as well. We'll be talking about this train stuff and Babylon Bee trying to be funny about Stephen King. We'll be close reading some comedy writing and judging it.
Oh, I saw that. That was really lame.
Maybe the lamest comedy writing of all. Like I edited both high school and college newspapers that would do spoof editions for April 1st with like amateurs writing all the... All better written than
right.
That.
Right, yes. hey, folks, also just want to address for the last time the massive controversy around established titles. This was a sponsor that was on the program. They sell what we called a novelty gift, which is you – call yourself a lord or a lady. You get a certificate that states that you are, and also provides a souvenir title to, which my understanding is they're not allowed to issue titles for land parcels that are one by one in Scotland. I don't know if you can do that in this country either, frankly. It's a souvenir title portion of land that is owned by the company that runs Established Titles. I don't know what the name of the company is. And they plant a tree on that piece of property based upon the purchase of one of these Established Titles. They're there was a controversy around the company because I saw a video which, you know, made it clear that you're not really a lord or a lady. I have to be honest. I don't know what the difference between being a real lord or a real lady is and a sort of like novelty one. In this country, we don't have those. We don't have princesses. We don't have princes. We don't have queens. We don't have kings. We don't have dukes. We don't have earls. There's nobody's knighted. Nobody's a sir. Like, I don't, like, and I don't know if there's special privileges that come with that or should come with that. I assumed that people were aware that you could call yourself Lord on, you know, if you want, on your plane ticket, I guess, maybe, as instead of Mr. or Mrs. Of course, you can also call yourself Mr. or Mrs. at your own will as well. It doesn't really afford you any special privileges in my notion. But nevertheless, there was a big controversy about it. And, you know, we addressed it, I think, on the fun half yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, from my perspective, I was from our media broker. They showed evidence to me that they were the trees were being planted as said, which was like sort of the biggest issue for me. If there was, if that would have been the biggest issue, nevertheless, apparently established titles is taking a lot of grief online. I guess they've bought you know, ads across the YouTube, and they have stopped. They have stopped. What's that? That's just
that's Milo. Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
Established titles is on the desk there.
Oh, is that right? Oh, that's funny. That's funny. And so they there it is. But they have stopped. They've pulled their advertising entire campaign, I guess, across YouTube, or they certainly have from us. So. We're not going to be advertising for them anymore, but you should know that it's really more their choice than mine. I still, you know.
You're still a lord.
You're still a lord as far as I'm concerned. I'm a lord and a lady, and I made it clear to people that I was both. And so, you know.
I got a meeting with the Star Registry people this afternoon trying to replace them as an advertiser. So
there you go. Yes, apparently that star yourself, you don't own it.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
If you go to that solar system, like, no one's going to recognize you as like the rightful owner of it, which is fraudulent.
Okay, so your left testicle says to me, to my understanding, Sam, real lords and ladies are entitled to income from the land they own. Typically, it is their equivalent of property taxes called residency fees, just an extra way to leech off others. I could be wrong. This is just what was explained to me. If in any way I implied that you would be able to,
you become land, a landlord if then, you bought.
I don't know.
If you, yeah, you, the promise to extract the resources from this plot of land, I think, was probably overselling it.
I should not have said that you can go and there could be oil there.
You got the mineral rights.
But I'm sorry if that was like, I don't know if people were offended by it or whatnot. You should know that, like, at literally almost every day, at least, let me put it this way, at least once or twice a week, I reject ads from companies that I don't, that, you know, that are, because the industry I don't think is appropriate to do on this show for, you know, sort of like, you know, all sorts of reasons. And or for, you know, I don't like the product. I also won't do it. You know, we've stopped campaigns in the past for, you know, when we find out stuff about different entities, we, you know, for all different reasons, we've done this.
This doesn't feel like those.
This does not feel like that. This is not, as far as I know now, if like, you know, like somebody said, like, the land is actually like in the occupied territories.
Right.
I would be like, okay, there's a problem. Or if it's like, this is, I don't know.
Like, they burn down the forest first and then they plant the tree.
It's actually Amazonian.
They're chopping down the trees as a way of making space to replant the trees. I don't know. But there you go. Mike says, just so you know, Lomi is also a scam. I know you did an ad from the week or so ago. It's not actually a composter. It doesn't actually work as one. It's overpriced bread maker, which burns. I watched that YouTube. We got feedback. I am not, you know, I have not investigated this product enough to make any claims about it, but I will tell you that we're not doing any more ads for them. So, like, that's just an example, which I had totally forgot about, to be honest with you. And what kind of ads have we rejected outright? I won't do any financial industry ads. I won't do any, you know, gig economy ads.
Gambling.
I won't do any gambling ads. Like, you know, I think it's like perfectly legitimate to do gambling ads, frankly, on ESPN. But like on this show, like it's just not something that I feel comfortable with. But like the gig economy ones, like we had a producer who we found out was producing in the occupied territories. I loved the product. I loved the product. But I just didn't, it doesn't comport with my politics or the politics on this show. If other people feel comfortable with it, that's perfectly fine. I'm not making a judgment there. I'm just doing it in terms of this show. You know, we rejected everything from like E-Trade and this and that, not because I think that you shouldn't involve with stocks. If you want to do that, do it. Things like gold and this and that, you know, like I'm not interested in pushing that. I'm not interested in pushing crypto. You know, like I've had all this stuff before. So there you go. All right. I'll tell you something right now. Andrew Tate, dick pill ads. No, we welcome those. We just haven't gotten any offers.
There's a very funny sports podcast, I think, covering like the Cavaliers or maybe the Sixers, where a guy didn't know what the ad was and he started reading it and realized it was like a Blue Chew ad or something like that for, boner pills. And he's like, oh, if you need that, go to this website.
I'll listen to those sports podcasts and they're all, you know, usually very male oriented ads. And some of them are like, just like about shaving, like your under area. And like, there's just so much like graphic garbage in it, but whatever. So that's up next for us, obviously.
And so, you know, that's that. Like, you can send more comments, but I'm not going to address it any more than that because it's, you know,
well,
every now and then we'll do a little navel gazing in that way. But for the most part, no. I mean, we just trying to think what the funniest ad that we ever rejected. I don't know.
The funniest that rejected us was when that Indian Summer BBC show heard Michael do the Libertarian Gandhi impression during the ad and was like, we're not going to have them.
That's not helping us. That's not helping us. But yes, if Elon Musk calls and to do Twitter ads, I will take his money, but I don't think that'll happen. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the breaks.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot
of bank, okay? I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am in total. Pussy, 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 pussy.